How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello there, everyone. We're locked in for episode 216 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. I'm your host, Fred Katz. Locked On Thunder is part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Head on to iTunes, search Locked On Thunder, subscribe to the podcast there, leave a review once you're on that page, and find us on audioboom.com. Log on to normantranscript.com. Check out my blog, Thunder Road. It's under the sports tab on the site. You can see all my Thunder coverage there. I'm on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. As always, today is the Friday episode. I got my good buddy Danny LaRue coming on. He does the Dunked On Basketball podcast. He does the Real GM podcast. He writes the Real GM Sporting News. I mean, you probably know him on Twitter at Danny LaRue. Like, he's everywhere. He's a great CBA guy. He's a great cap guy. He's awesome free agency, player movement, any of that stuff, the intricacies of the rules of the league. He's fantastic at that, and I think he's awesome to have on for an off-season preview type of podcast. That's what we're going to have. Free agency starts 12:01 a.m. Saturday morning. So if you want to stay up late, that's 12:01 a.m. Eastern time, by the way. So if you want to stay up, you can stay up a little bit late, and or maybe if you're on the West Coast, you can just stay up till a normal hour, and you can follow free agency right in the back, because something always happens, whether it's a signing, whether it's something, you know, some kind of big news ends up happening within the first hour. Often multiple pieces of big news happen within the first hour because guys have meetings with teams right away, and for the Thunder, they're going to be looking forward to seeing what the heck happens with Russell Westbrook and an extension, because that's the moment where they can officially present an extension to Russell Westbrook right away. We're going to get to that conversation with Danny in one quick second, but before we do, I just want to take a moment to talk about SeatGeek. Buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a confusing process for a long time. It's always been hard to find the best deal for that game or show you want to go to, and none of those older ticket sites want to change that. But SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. SeatGeek is always the first place I go to look for tickets to a game or concert. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and I just used it the other day to look at concert tickets to see if anything was coming to Oklahoma City. Everything about SeatGeek is designed to make life easier for sports and music fans. SeatGeek does all the price comparison for you by searching multiple ticket sites and ensuring that you get the best possible deal. SeatGeek does all the work and you save the time and money. And SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You'll immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Best of all, my listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the SeatGeek app, go to the Settings tab, click Add a Promo Code. Enter the promo code LO Thunder. That's LO like locked on. And SeatGeek is going to give you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. Download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code LO Thunder today. Quick break, and then let's get to the offseason preview.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily Oklahoma City Thunder podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Danny LaRue, we welcome you back. How you doing?
Doing well, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. I'm ready. This is like your time of year. Like, is this, do you sleep during this time of year? When does the sleep like just go away?
Well, the sleep went away when I was writing my book. Now it's okay. You know, you get in a couple hours when you can, but I've become more okay with the idea of missing something immediately when it happens. You know, not necessarily on July 1st, but around that, like, you just know it's going to happen. But at certain points, you get too amped. Like, I think that's it for me. It's not the FOMO, like the fear of missing out. It's just that you're so excited that you can't get into it. And so, like, for example, when the Chris Paul trade happened, we had recorded a Phil Jackson podcast that had, like, we stayed up until like 1:30 to do that. I was so amped I didn't fall asleep until 3, and then that's why I woke up like right as the Chris Paul news broke.
So Danny, for those who don't know, is like an off season and and CBA extraordinaire. Can we call you an extraordinaire?
I think that's allowed.
Okay, we'll call it extraordinaire then. And we're doing an off-season preview today. That's, I mean, it's free agency starts Saturday morning, 12:01 a.m. This is coming out Friday morning, so you've got your day for free agency preview. But one thing I do want to ask you, because we're recording this on late Thursday, I want to know what your reaction was to, what was your first reaction to the Chris Paul deal yesterday?
Excitement. I always enjoy, as much as you talk about that, I mentioned that I'm a CBA guy, I enjoy the experience of a new team in a new circumstance, and Chris Paul, James Harden playing together is certainly that. I mean, these are two extremely talented, extremely ball-dominant players on the same team, and I want to see how that works out. Also, the CBA nerd in me was excited to see how the trade was actually going to work from a mechanical perspective. And as we were recording the Dunked On Mock Off Season podcast, we all have our kind of our Twitters going, and we start seeing these little mechanics of the trade of all these non-guaranteed contracts. So that part of it was fun. But for me, the biggest part is always the basketball, and the basketball of it is going to be really fun.
So the non-guaranteed stuff is stuff that's not going to be allowed come July 1st, right?
I'm not entirely sure that's a part of the CBA, the new CBA that I need to go through in terms of, but my understanding of that is correct, is that once you hit this transition point, that it counts towards the next year, like the guaranteed money. And so that's the way I understand it. But I want to go in and read line by line to see where this goes. But that's right. My understanding, yes.
Right. So do you like that rule? I kind of like, I understand that it sucks for the players, and I get that. Being Ridenoured across the NBA 15 times in an offseason is pretty crappy for an NBA player. Getting traded once is pretty crappy for a player. It's an awful lifestyle. And people have written about that and told that story many times, how crappy it is to be traded. And if you're a human being, you can get that. But I kind of think, like, it's a cool little tidbit that teams can do. Like, I thought that was really interesting when they're how Houston's just gobbling up as many non-guarantees as it possibly can to make deals work. I kind of think that's a fun part of the NBA. Granted, I am in the remarkable minority on this. But I feel like you might be part of that minority.
I draw a big distinction between being traded in season and being traded in the off season. Because when you're traded in season, yes, that is completely upending your whole life for those players who have kids and families, and almost everybody has roots of some form. I totally sympathize with that. I see an off-season trade very differently, especially in this context, because a lot of those guys were non-guaranteed. And remember, these are non-guaranteed players that the teams are willing to trade functionally for nothing. This is not Jeremy Grant getting traded to fulfill this trade. These are guys that may or may not be in the NBA next year. So at that point, it's not like you're moving, these guys are moving from to Houston and then moving to Los Angeles physically. They're just going to go where they're playing in summer league. They're going to go to who ends up signing them long term. So I am sympathetic broadly, but in this specific circumstance, I understand why, and I actually value the flexibility. I mean, it's going to be harder to get trades done, and I think it's good to have that if you have two like consenting sides and the only thing that's an issue is this kind of thing, this kind of like minutia. I'm fine with using that to make it happen.
So you're saying that the Matt Barnes Charlotte Hornets era was not something that you'll remember?
Correct.
Who else was Ridenour traded for? There was Jeremy Lamb was in there.
Jeremy Lamb was in there. I mean, it was a lot of different things.
Matt Barnes was in there. That was an amazing thing.
Because I think it was like a flurry over about a week, and then it came back, I think, like a month later, if memory serves. Like, it was something around the draft and free agency, and then I think it popped in one or two more times before his contract guaranteed.
Yeah, so there's Tomislav Zubcic to the Raptors. That was Thunder Raptors. Giannis Tima was the Memphis deal. And there are a couple others too. There's Jeremy Lamb, straight up for Matt Barnes, straight up for all those guys in one offseason, all in different deals. Amazing, amazing thing. And that is obviously part of what they're trying to avoid with this, that sort of situation. But man, that was, and then he retired.
And then he retired. And I totally feel sympathetic also for a guy who was a an NBA player of renown. I mean, people lose sight of that, who is in many ways, maybe it's just in the places where he didn't play, remembered for being traded as opposed to his career.
Yeah, and Ridenour got... There's some sort of pun that they got rid of him every hour, but I've never been able to figure it out.
No, I would leave that to you to figure out before myself, or maybe like Bill Oram, we could figure it out before both of us.
Yeah, Bill Oram is worse than I am, for the record, with that.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no question.
Like, he causes me physical pain periodically, and that's impressive. As somebody else who enjoys bad puns, to be able to make it so cringy that it gets me, yeah.
You know what I think is a really intriguing part of the Chris Paul deal?
Sure.
And I'm just the way that Chris Paul. So when the deal was first made, I was on an airplane coming back from New York, coming back from the award show in New York, and everything went down while I was on the plane. So I land and I just check Twitter, and the first thing I see is Ramona Shelburne tweeting out Jamal Crawford, like retweeting Jamal Crawford saying that like he'll miss Chris Paul. And I was like, what? What is going on? Now I see people tweeting about Chris Paul going to the Rockets. And I'm confused because I'm like waking up from sleeping on the plane, which I had pulled an all-nighter to get on. So I'm kind of out of it and in kind of this like groggy mood. And I'm like, how the hell did Chris Paul sign with the Rockets on July 28th? Like I felt like I was going insane, you know, or on June 28th. Like I felt like I was going insane that someone would sign with another team before free agency started. And then I see he picked up the option and they made a trade. And I think the most amazing thing for Chris Paul is that Chris Paul got what he wanted in terms of the team he wanted to go to. And instead of signing like a four-year, $149, $150 million contract, he's now going to be able to get this year's money. And then he's going to be able to sign for that five-year, 35% max next year. And he's going to, because his bird rights go with him to the trade. So he's going to get the bigger contract he wants on the team that he wants if he chooses to return there next year. That is a heck of a way to maneuver a free agency decision.
And remember also that if it doesn't work for whatever reason, if that's fit, if that's style, or if there's a personal conflict with D'Antoni or Harden, he can leave. Someone will offer him a contract very similar to the contract he would have taken had he left in the first place. So he gets basically a trial run at this. They get a trial run at him. And that is incredibly fortunate for Chris Paul, unless some sort of injury happens and then, you know, he's dealing with risk. But another funny part of this, to get into my CBA nerd, is this is the second major trade involving Chris Paul where he picked up an option. Like that's it's an extremely rare thing to happen. And it's happened to him twice because that was part of what facilitated the Clippers trade in the first place. They didn't want him to be able to opt out immediately.
Right, and it's a slightly different option picking up situation because this time he's opting in for 1 year. Clippers really opted in for two.
Well, yeah, the difference was it was more about when the option was as opposed to, but yeah, it's the same. But I just think it's interesting that it happened twice in conjunction with trades with him.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't make that connection, man. God, that
if only you had some sort of connection with the Clippers that would make you remember that original deal.
That was back in my Clippers fandom. That's how you really know. I haven't been like a Clippers fan in a little while. Like as you very well know, and some people who don't work in this don't fully understand it, but you just lose the fandom when you're covering a team. You just completely lose it. You have rooting interests. It's just different things. Like I root for things that make my travel schedule easier. You know? Like that's what I root for. Like when the Cavs were up 3-0 against Indiana. The hardest I rooted for a team all year was I admittedly rooted extremely hard for Cleveland in game four of the first round against Indiana. And the reason was because it was like the following game would have been on like a Tuesday night or something like that, game five, and it would have preceded the Thunder game. So if Cleveland won that game and eliminated Indiana right there, the Thunder were going to play at 7 o'clock. And if Cleveland won, the Thunder were going to play at 8:30, and I was going to have to write, like, I was going to have to get something in on the buzzer, and my deadline was going to be pressed, and it was going to be a pain. It was a total pain. So I was rooting so hard for that 7 o'clock start time, and when Cleveland won, it was a close game. That was when J.R. Smith had that hilarious behind-the-back pass turnover. It was a close game, but Cleveland won. I was extremely excited. So we root for things. We just root for weird things that selfishly affect us and not other people.
Yeah, that's certainly true. It's been weird for me because I didn't grow up a Warriors fan. I grew up in the Bay Area, but I didn't grow up. I was aware of them, but I wasn't a big basketball fan earlier in life. But I was a huge San Francisco Giants and 49ers fan, and I covered both those teams in my early days of doing sports media. And I found that was much less comfortable than covering the Warriors because even though I didn't, was an outsider or anything like that, I had a different level of personal investment, and I didn't like that. It was uncomfortable for me.
Yeah, no, I completely get that, because I used to blog about the Clippers, as you know, back in the day, and I totally get that, but you just kind of lose it. And it was funny because I don't even think about the Clippers in that way anymore. I'll relate to the fan base because I have friends who are Clippers fans, and I kind of associated with the fan base for such a large portion of my life. You know, it's like that community you still feel like I feel for that fan base today, because there are a lot of miserable people. There are a lot of bandwagon Clippers fans, but like the Clippers, like the pre-2011 Clippers fans, or the pre-Blake Griffin, like 2010 Clippers fans, those Clippers fans are a miserable group of people. They're just extremely depressed about basketball for every reason that you would be for being a Clippers fan. And those people are, I think, pretty down about this. And I feel for those people, but it's kind of weird when you spend like 20 years of your life as a Clippers fan, and then they trade away by far the best player in the history of their franchise, and you just have no reaction to it other than like, oh man, that's a really interesting move by Chris Paul, because now he can get the 35% max in Houston, and oh my goodness, how's he going to mesh with Harden, and how good is Houston going to be, and are they better in San Antonio now? And you're just thinking about it from a purely basketball perspective. It was kind of like closure on my, even though my relationship with the Clippers ended years ago, it's kind of a real confirmed closure moment.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a fair way of thinking about it. But we can talk about some other closure moments that are probably going to happen in this offseason.
Okay, let's talk about the Thunder a little bit. This is a Thunder podcast.
Yeah. They will have fewer closure moments.
Yes, they will. So as of right now, as of today, as of June 29th, the Thunder have over $111 million on the books, closer to $112 million on the books. I'm including Jeremy Grant's team option, even though that is not 100% official at the time we're recording this, but it will be official at some point real soon, probably by the time people actually listen to this. So Jeremy Grant's team option, I'm including, they're close to $112 million on the books. The salary cap is projected at $99 million. The luxury tax is projected at $119 million. They still have to sign their first-round pick, Terrence Ferguson, which is going to bring them up closer to $113 million, depending on what percentage of the rookie scale he gets. We're not sure about that, but let's call it $113 for round numbers. That's going to put them $6 million away from the luxury tax. They would like to re-sign Andre Roberson. Taj Gibson's a free agent, unrestricted. Roberson is restricted. Nick Collison is unrestricted. And they have pieces that they need to add. They could use a shooter. They could use a backup point guard. Samaje Christen is non-guaranteed until July 7th, but he's only worth $1.3 million, so they could conceivably keep him around, make him a third string. They'd like to add things, but they're going to be scrunched. Like, it's going to be – I think they'd like to avoid the tax, but if they want to get better, it might be inevitable.
I agree with you that it probably is. And a big challenge for Sam Presti is that Oklahoma City doesn't have a lot of movable contracts. And you can think of movable contracts in a couple different ways. One is players that are good values on their deal. And so you have those. But then the other ones are there are players that you just don't want to trade. So like Russell Westbrook is a movable contract in a technical sense, but he is not because Oklahoma City is not trading him. So when you look through that, when you look through their roster and you say, okay, who is good and a reasonable value and non-essential, you're getting into a very narrow list because, like Kyle Singler, they could lose his money, but nobody really wants it. Doug McDermott, they want to keep. Jeremy Grant, they want to keep. And so thinning it out a little bit, finding $6 million, kind of like that type of a guy to just dump on somebody, doesn't really exist with their team unless they want to make something much, much bigger, which they certainly could, but it's a real challenge.
It is, and I think that's really well put. I mean, the one thing that I think people have to understand is you see a lot of people saying that the Thunder need to get rid of Enes Kanter's contract. They have to dump Enes Kanter, and that's obviously, if they were able to do that, that would be the easiest way to dump something like that, right? If they were just able to unload the $18 million that they owe Canna for next year. I'm not quite sure how they'd be able to do that. I don't really know who's taking him into space. You kind of have to sweeten the deal. And as I've said on this podcast before, offense first, defense absent centers are extremely difficult to trade in this market. In June of 2017, you know, Brook Lopez just got traded, but he's a significantly better defensive player than Enes Kanter is. He's only got 1 year left on his deal. Kanter has the 2018 player option. And on top of that, that was part of the Lakers trying to open up cap space and unload Mozgov's contract for future years. So that was something that came into account as well. But Orlando has tried to trade Nikola Vucevic. It hasn't worked. There have been times where Toronto has at least been open to deals with Valanciunas. Hasn't worked. You know, the Bucks had a while where they were trying to trade Greg Monroe. Hasn't worked. And Philly is, you know, trying to give away Jahlil Okafor, and nobody's going to take him, and he's on a rookie contract. And all those guys are on either slightly to much cheaper deals than Enes Kanter. So I don't know. Where do you stand on the ability to unload Enes Kanter and the importance of unloading Enes Kanter?
It only matters if ownership is very gung-ho or very dedicated to not paying the tax. You know, it doesn't increase their flexibility at all if ownership were willing to spend. It does increase it as a practical matter if ownership is not. You know, and that is a real constraint. I'm not trying to minimize that. I'm just trying to acknowledge the way that this actually works. As some, you know, I deal with that a lot with different teams. It's like people focus a lot on what can a team do, and can is often the wrong question to ask. It's what should and what will they do. With Kanter, a good illustration of this is yesterday after the Chris Paul trade, my thought, if I were running the Clippers, would be it's kind of time to tear down some of their other stuff just because they're not going to be as competitive this year. So my thought process went to, okay, what if they wanted to trade DeAndre Jordan? DeAndre Jordan is unquestionably a superior player to Enes Kanter, but they would be expecting assets back. And so I was just going through who needs a center, who wants a center, who has space. And that question is brutally hard. So you can think about what it would be for Enes Kanter, who is a worse player on a less favorable contract.
Right. I mean, the only thing I can really think of, I mean, you've got until tomorrow, until Rajon Rondo's contract guarantees for next year, right? Maybe if Chicago values Kanter higher, you can, you know, go Kanter for Rondo, and then you waive Rondo and you eat the $3 million that he's guaranteed.
The other logical thing, if Oklahoma City's willing to do it, is that you're not trading a guy into space. You're trading him for somebody on a smaller, maybe less favorable contract. So like maybe there's a guy who makes $10 million who is worse than Enes Kanter, and so that $6 million is helpful too. And I think that is a way that GMs are going to need to start thinking about trades, because as we get into the new salary landscape, now that the cap is flat and teams spent recklessly last summer, you're not really going to be trading guys into space anymore. You're going to be trading them for other players.
Right. There just aren't that many teams with space.
Correct.
Just aren't
that many. And the ones with space are going to be very judicious about it, because there aren't that many, and so they can squeeze resources out of the teams that are desperate.
Right. For sure. Like I mean, somebody suggested to me, like, what if Brooklyn's a place for Kanter that would maybe take him on? They have tons of cap room, and they just lost Brook Lopez, and they, you know, him and Lopez and Kanter, while I think Brook Lopez is a superior player in many ways, I you know, they're in the same category of style of player, you know, and so somebody suggested to me, what about him? Like, I just don't see how he fits them. I mean, they need good NBA players, Brooklyn does, and they don't benefit by tanking, but they also don't benefit by being a little bit better if it costs them anything in the future. You know, Enes Kanter is going to be, could be a free agent in 2018 and will be a free agent by 2019. And Brooklyn's not going to be competitive by that time. So are you going to, you know, maybe if the Thunder, if it gets the Thunder a pick, you know, maybe, or it gets Brooklyn a pick, maybe if the Thunder include Chicago's, you know, 2018 unprotected second rounder or something like that, maybe that's something that gets a team to take him. But I don't know if that's something, I don't think that's something the Thunder would want to do. I think they'd rather hold on to him if that's what it takes.
Remember also that there are probably 15 to 20 teams in the league that are also looking to shed salary in some form. And so you're not only competing in terms of quality of fit, but you're also competing in terms of assets. So while you don't know this for sure, especially because they didn't trade any of them this year for the draft picks, Portland is way too expensive. You know, the team that actually offered Enes Kanter that contract in the first place. They would probably give up a better asset to dump Myers Leonard or maybe even Evan Turner then OKC is going to give up for Kanter because they think Kanter is a better player. They don't need it as much, all those sorts of things. And the teams that have this space, the four or five that are really in that mix, they're going to be choosy because they have to be, because they really only get one or two bites at this. And so they're going to take the best offer. And I think it's unlikely that Oklahoma City makes the best offer. So they have to come into this offseason with a different kind of perspective. And I'm fascinated to see where the rubber meets the road in terms of who we're never really going to know who gets discussed in that sort of way. But like, where does this go? Is it really going to be like, let Roberson go? Is it going to be try to move on from one of these undesirable contracts? Or are you going to give up something of value to get one of these guys go?
I do think they want to bring back Roberson. That's something that
I think so too.
That's something that I at least people have made clear to me. The Thunder would like to bring back Roberson. He's extremely important to their defense. He's extremely important to what they try to do. He's obviously a weird fit in a lot of ways because what he is offensively. I think they're going to try to make him into a different style player. Like, I don't think he's going to be a guy, if he ends up back in Oklahoma City, I don't think he's going to be a guy who shoots as many threes next year. I think they're going to try to use him a little bit more like Memphis uses Tony Allen, and just try to make him a little bit more of a slasher and a cutter, and not necessarily just keep him in the corner and let him put up threes. Because I don't think they were particularly happy with it. And it's not necessarily a situation where they're blaming it on anybody. But I don't think I think they kind of look back on the results of what they saw this year with him taking almost three threes a game. And I don't think they believe now in retrospect that that was the most effective way to use him offensively. Yeah. Considering he's quick and he's a good athlete and all that stuff. Like, he doesn't have absolutely zero offensive options. It's not like he's this unathletic guy, you know?
You have to defend activity, even if it's somebody who can't shoot. And I've thought for a while now that that's the way to kind of handle it, is because you can't help off somebody who's moving all around, because then, and especially if you use them in the primary action. So like, you can't, for example, like, let's say there's a big man who, you know, isn't going to shoot outside the lane. Zaza Pachulia is a good example here. Steven Adams has a better float game, so I'm not going to use him. He's better than that. But let's say Pachulia. So like, okay, yeah, normally speaking, you wouldn't guard Pachulia 15, 20 feet from the rim. But if he's setting a screen, you have to, because otherwise the other guy's getting open. And so using players in that way challenges those defenders. And also, if a team is doing like what Houston achieved for so much of that playoff series and putting their worst guy on them, at the bare minimum, you're making James Harden run around an extra, you know, few thousand steps per half. So that's great. You're making him work harder. You're getting him a little bit more gas. Maybe he's going to miss a couple shots in crunch time.
Yeah, I wonder what else they're going to do, though. Okay, so you agree with me. The Thunder could use some more shooting. They were last in three-point shooting. The Thunder could use a backup point guard. They had one
of
the worst.
That's the biggest need.
I think that's the biggest need, too. They had one of the worst, if not the single worst, backup point guard situations in the NBA last year. I would say they, ironically, because they in Chicago made the Cameron Payne trade, I would say that they in Chicago had the worst backup point guard situation of any playoff-relevant teams last year. And they need to do something about that. Now, I doubt they're going to use the full mid-level, because if you use the full mid-level, for those who don't know, then you're hard-capped. So I doubt they're going to use the full mid-level. But I wouldn't be surprised if they used a portion of the mid-level to try to bring in some kind of backup point guard. There are a lot of decent backup point guards on the market this year. Like, a lot of them. There are a lot of good guys that you might be able to bring in for a solid price. Now, I don't think you're going to be able to get Patty Mills for the mid-level.
No.
I think he's going to be too expensive for that. I don't know if you're going to get Sean Livingston, but I think Raymond Felton is a possibility. Someone of that quality, I think you could convince him to come in and play at a quality role, because he had a good year as a backup with the Clippers this past season. And I think that someone of that quality is somebody you might see them bring in the mid-level. Is that how you would try to use the mid-level too? I mean, obviously, you know, it depends on circumstance and that kind of stuff, but if you could have it ideally, is that how you would try to use it?
Probably. I would also consider just using up to the taxpayer mid-level line, which is lower, because basically that way, depending on how much they spend, you can make it work. But the other option that they have for team building, and it's going to depend on supply, is they still have a trade exception from Ersan Ilyasova from the Jeremy Grant trade. That doesn't expire until November. I have it that they have about $5 million remaining on that.
Yeah, it's 4.9.
The benefit of that, so you cannot acquire You can't sign a free agent with that. But if there's a superfluous point guard somewhere else, kind of the equivalent of a Shabazz Napier, and I think they should be looking higher for point guards than that, but you might be able to get somebody in that realm for basically nothing. And so you can take a flyer on them, and then maybe then you have another potential answer to this question. And so that's something that they should consider using. And we're still at the point now, because some of these older contracts are still out there, where $5 million doesn't get you much now. But maybe before, you know, it's a player of some import. I haven't really gone through that with OKC yet, but that's certainly a potential option. And generally speaking, you're going to get a player using a trade exception who is on a shorter contract than somebody who's signing this offseason, because everybody wants years. That's just a big part of it. You know, you want that security if a team's going to spend on you. And Oklahoma City, you know, they can figure this out year by year at backup point guard if they're going to pencil in Russell Westbrook for the lion's share, not only of regular season minutes, but an even larger share of playoff minutes.
That's smart. The trade exception would be an interesting way to go about that. I wonder if that's something that that they might be able to do. What do you make of the Rudy Gay talk? I mean, I've always thought it was a little bit weird. To be honest, I don't see the Thunder have been interested in Rudy Gay since last summer. I don't see the fit, to be honest. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Rudy Gay's game to begin with, and I think he's probably more of a four than he is a three. And who knows how he's going to recover? He's 30 years old. He'll be 31 by the start of training camp. Who knows that 31-year-old is going to recover from a season-ending Achilles injury? I mean, those kill pretty much anyone. I mean, historically, only really Dominique has recovered from something like that. And if you think he was probably more of a four in today's NBA game before that, I think it's fair to assume that it's going to go even further in that direction. It's probably not going to get any better coming off the Achilles. And I don't know if stylistically he works next to Westbrook. He's not a huge floor spacer, and he's a guy who works better with the ball in his hands. I'd rather have the ball in Russell Westbrook's hands. I realize they need a secondary creator, but is he the guy you would consider as that guy?
No, I don't think he cares what ails them.
I don't get it.
I think something that happens sometimes, and I think this you brought up the kind of the trading with Chicago, though this wasn't the trade with OKC, with Chris Dunn, that a team sometimes, a front office, can fixate on a player for too long, and you kind of fall in love with what they were or the idea of them, as opposed to
Can we call that the Solomon Hill theorem?
Sure.
Because that is what happened with Solomon Hill in New Orleans last summer. They wanted to draft him, and then they wanted him for 3 years, and then he became a free agent. They're like, oh, Solomon Hill, here's millions upon millions upon millions of dollars, and now they have Solomon Hill for, what is it, 4 for $48?
Something like that.
It's
yeah. Those are real challenging areas, and with Rudy Gay, there's an intervening factor here, which was the injury you talked about, and that the Oklahoma City Thunder have changed substantially as a team over the last little while. You know, they're building around Russell Westbrook. Think about what we just talked about as their biggest needs. Backup point guard and shooting, so that they can, you know, that things can balance out. I think if they want a secondary creator, they have Victor Oladipo. Oladipo can do that more than he was asked to last year. And a backup point guard then, of course, can hit shoulder the load when Russell Westbrook is out. So they have finite resources. And sure, if a player doesn't fit but is so good that you'll just make it work, that can happen, obviously. Teams do that all the time. But I don't think Rudy Gay is that guy. I don't think he is the one where you break the mold for him at this point, especially with the risk involved. So I would caution against it. Unless it's, you know, super cheap. If it's not really costing you resources, you know, if you, for whatever reason he wants a make good contract with the Thunder, which doesn't really make any sense, but if, let's say, he did, then you have that conversation. But outside of that, I think you're looking in other directions.
Right. I mean, I'm curious to see what the market is going to be for Gay just coming off the injury. That's going to be an interesting subplot of the summer, just to see how people value him coming off the injury, because Wes Matthews got a really big contract, but the circumstances of that contract were a little bit strange, because there was the whole DeAndre thing with the Mavs, and he had originally agreed to a smaller contract, and then when DeAndre, after the moratorium, went back to the Clippers, or at the end of it, went back to the Clippers, the Mavs didn't really have anybody else to sign. They said, oh, okay, we'll up your deal. So he ended up getting a little bit more after that, and now people look at that deal, and it's not like Wes Matthews is a bad player now, but that's a contract that pays him more than he's probably worth. He's been, you know, take your pick, he's 75% or 80% or 90% of the player that he was in Portland, but he's not the same player that he was in Portland. And guys just don't recover from the Achilles. It's really like the one like body part injury that guys still to this day really consistently struggle to regain their form from. And
it's scary with older players too. I mean, Rudy Gay's not old like Kobe was, but he's on the older side. And so you think about how long it takes to recover and the uncertainty of that recovery. It's a real concern. And I would advise that another team take that risk, a team that is not as competitive as the Thunder are, or a team that if it doesn't work, it didn't cost them that much. But with Oklahoma City, I mean, they don't have that many tools. They don't have that many ways to get better. They do have alternatives. I mean, I like Terrence Ferguson. I thought he was an intriguing talent. I saw him, I think it was at the 2016 Hoop Summit, and I liked him. But I don't think he's going to be ready to, like, if Rudy Gay doesn't work, oh, let's just give Terrence Ferguson that role. That's not the way this works.
Right. And I'm definitely curious to see how he does. If the Thunder, if they get Rudy Gay, if Rudy Gay, for some reason, for some crazy reason, he'll take the minimum, or he'll take the room exception or something like that, that's fine. I'm fine with that. I mean, that's perfectly fine to take a risk on him to see if he can come back and do it. But yeah, if you're going to waste an actual resource on it, I don't know. I think there are better ways to go about it. I really think
And like, what's the upside? So if, let's say Rudy Gay, even if he does well enough that he's your starting three, let's say, that team is not that challenging to defend unless Rudy Gay is 100% of what he was, let's say, his best form in the last 2 years. And that's possible. I'm never going to write off a guy, but it's unlikely. And they still have some of the same limitations that they had with Robertson, except that Gay is a lot worse than Andre Robertson as a defender and as a kind of like a functional piece in those sorts of ways. So granted, I'm lower on Rudy Gay than most people and have been for basically ever. Which is, you know, that is no guarantee that I'll be right on it forever, but I just don't see the play there. And Oklahoma City, I'm going to be fascinated to see whether they can use, you know, Russell Westbrook, of course, winning the MVP and their surprising success. Billy Donovan is a wonderful coach, to get somebody, maybe not to take a pay cut, but to get somebody to listen to their offer and say, hey, we have a vision for where you can fit in and we can do that. And I hope so, because I think it would be make their team better and they'd be more fun to watch and everything like that. But we still have to see it.
Yeah, they could just – I would much rather spend it if it's a possibility. I would much rather, if you're talking about like a mid-level deal or something like that, I'd rather give that to like Joe Ingles. I'd much rather give that to someone like Joe Ingles who can perform well off the ball, defend a little bit. A CJ Miles who is actually signed an offer sheet with the Thunder before. So, you know, they, you know, do you know this? Here's a trivia question for you. You know, the biggest, and I like asking this to people, do you know the biggest contract the Thunder have ever given to another team's free agent in their history?
Oh, you mean that the player actually ended up on the Thunder?
Yes.
Oh, it was a big guy. It was a Euro. I'm trying to remember his name, but I know who, like, God, what is his name? But I know who you're talking about. I just can't. My finger's not on it.
You want me to tell you?
Yeah.
It was Nenad Krstić.
Krstić. Yep, that's right.
Yep.
Yeah, I was going to say was on the Celtics, and then I still wouldn't have figured it out from there. But yeah, I mean.
Do you know what the contract was?
3 years, $6 million?
3 years, 15.
Oh, 15. That's right. Six a year. Oh, close.
Five a year. Yeah. It was that's the most total money they've ever given to another team's free agent. Second biggest was the Anthony Morrow 3-year $10 million deal. So them even just signing someone to the mid-level exception would probably be the largest amount of total money they've ever given out to another team's free agent if they were going to do that. And obviously, circumstances now with the salary cap up are completely different. But and I think Krstić's deal was the mid-level. It sounds like the mid-level. So I think it actually was for the mid-level in 2008 when they signed that deal. But they historically have not gotten high-priced guys. And that's in part because of the way that they built their team and they've often been, you know, re-signing guys or been over the cap or they've drafted so well that the option of, you know, having this up-and-coming 23-year-old on a rookie deal is significantly better than signing somebody for $10 million a year. But now they're in a situation where they're going to have to get those guys and guys don't historically sign in Oklahoma City. So I will be interested to see what that is. But I mean, if they could get a Joe Ingles for that price, I feel like Joe Ingles might price out of it a little bit. But if he, for some reason, wanted to come,
That would be someone who I think could help. But just someone in that mold, I think I would rather have. Someone who can star off the ball, who's going to do the gritty work, who's going to shoot well, who's going to be a lower usage guy, or at least not necessarily, you know, hijack the offense. I think I would prefer someone of that style if I were Oklahoma City.
The bad news is there are very, very few of those guys.
Yeah,
so
there are.
We don't know if they're going to be valuable or if it's just going to be, I mean, CJ Miles has kind of become an afterthought in Indiana. So if he becomes an afterthought again, then you can do that. But there aren't that many teams that, you know, he fits in a lot of places, what I was going to say. Like, there aren't that many teams that have that spot filled. So, like, and when we did the mock-off season, like, he got a lot of money from Philly, not necessarily because he was their top option, but because every other option became unavailable. And so that's the timing of this offseason is also going to be important because there is so much less money. I have a piece coming out for the Sporting News on Friday when this podcast, most people listen to it, about how there are, of course, contracts that don't count into this. But last year, in terms of what I call capacity to spend using cap space or exceptions, there was about $1 billion in that year's salary that was out there. This year, that is about $400 million. That is a massive difference. And yes, there are fewer free agents this year because a lot of guys timed things up for that year and they were smart too. LeBron is an example of it. I mean, lots of guys are. And so you have that circumstance, but there will be values, but there also are going to be guys that get overpaid because that's just the way this works.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'll see. There are some other guys who fit that description. I guess there's James Johnson, who had a really good year. I mean, I think he could be too expensive. There's P.J. Tucker, who I think was really good after the trade in Toronto. I mean, there are a couple of those guys who fit that. Obviously, on a greater level, there's Danilo Gallinari, who's probably more of a four now than he is a three. I don't know if he's like – I don't think he's like a straight three. There's Tony Snell, but I think he's going to be priced out of the Thunder's range as well. There are some guys – who at least their value to the Thunder might not be that the Thunder are able to sign them, but at least they go to another team that might be interested in that type of player, so at least that team is no longer a threat for someone more on the Thunder's price range.
Sure.
What about
old friend Thabo Sefolosha?
Thabo Sefolosha, yeah. Maybe, I mean, he was there for a long time, so maybe he's the type of guy that you'd convince to sign.
Yeah, and the Thunder are also competitive. Like, you need a hook on all these guys, even if it's a lower-level free agent. Not saying Thabo is, but with anybody, you want a reason for them to come. And so that can be lifestyle, that can be playing time, it can be scheme, it can be opportunity to make more money on your next contract, you know, all those sorts of things. And I think that Oklahoma City has better pitches on that than they have in recent years if they're willing to spend, just because there are gaps that they need to have filled, and they're going to be competitive. They're going to be in the mix for the playoffs, assuming they bring back a largely similar roster. So I'm intrigued to see whether that actually works or not. And my instinct is that they should be on the unrestricted market, not the restricted market, because basically I think anybody that they would be willing to spend on that is restricted, those guys are probably going to get matched just because the tools that Oklahoma City has to spend on, those are reasonable. You talked about Tony Snell. Like, if Tony Snell can get signed by the Thunder for, even if it's the maximum they have, which is the full non-taxpayer middle-level exception, that's like the most they could conceivably spend, I'm fully confident that the Bucks would match that.
Right.
So as a practical matter, you're looking at the unrestricted market, and then you're just kind of seeing what's out there. But Oklahoma City could be a team that benefits by being patient because, as I said, you know, there's so much less money around this year. That means it's going to dry up. There are going to be players without a chair when the music stops, and then they're going to have to completely reevaluate where they are and what they're doing. And at that point, if Oklahoma City's still there with whatever spending capital they have, they're going to look a whole lot better when there are no offers left for 3 years and $40 million. When all that's left are things more in their range, and then you can say, hey, look, you can come here, you're going to get playing time, you get to play on a playoff team for 1 year maybe, let's do it. And maybe then they become receptive.
You got a couple minutes to talk about Russ before we go?
Of course.
Because we're saving the most important part of the Thunder's offseason for last. Because the most important part of the Thunder offseason is that right away, they're going to go up to Russell Westbrook, and they're going to say, here is a five-year, $200-plus million contract that starts in 2018. please, oh, please, oh, please sign it. And they're going to wait to see what his decision is. And he has publicly basically said he's not talking about it. His answer, his the Westbrook company line has been, that's not something I've thought about. That's what he said in exit interviews. That's what he said when he was asked about it after the MVP, after winning MVP on June 26th, 5 days away from free agency. That was on Monday. Said he hadn't thought about it. There's something he's not thinking about right now. Guess what? I don't believe him. Amazingly, I don't believe him. I think he's thought about it. I know he's thought about it. I don't know what his answer is going to be. If I had to guess, my guess would be that he's going to re-sign it, if only because there are people who are optimistic about it. But guess what? There are people who are optimistic about Kevin Durant on June 29th of 2016, too. And that didn't turn out great for the Thunder. So I would guess that he's going to do it. But that is going to make or break their offseason.
It changes the entire landscape, not only for the Thunder, but for the entire league, whatever he does, which way he goes on that. Because you and I talked a little bit last night about Los Angeles. And Los Angeles now, with the moves that happened yesterday when we're recording this on Wednesday, made it so that there's a very real chance both Los Angeles teams are going to have two max slots. The things can change, but that's kind of the understanding that I'm operating from for right now. And so if Russell Westbrook decides that he wants to be a free agent next year, that's not saying he's guaranteed to go there or anything like that, but it just completely changes not only the way that the Thunder think about it, and if they wanted to listen to my opinion, I would say, then you trade him instantly. You trade him as soon as – I mean, obviously you shot for the best offer, but that's what you do because you can't let him go for nothing. As great as he is, the reigning MVP, deserving MVP. And so it totally changes it because then if you're Chris Paul, if you're Paul George, all these guys, it just changes everything. And it's so hard because – he has made it, and I understand why, he has made it very unclear where he is on it, and so they're just going to find out. And so you basically, if I were Sam Presti, you have two full, totally different plans. You have the if Russ stays and if Russ goes. And that's what a GM has to do. That's why their jobs are hard. And I'm intrigued by it. I think if I had to guess, and I have no inside information, that he's more likely than not to accept it, not necessarily because it's life-changing money, but because he has a pretty favorable situation. But I'm not confident in that at all. Nobody should be.
Yeah. No, I don't think anybody should be extremely confident in either direction. The Thunder are in a really sticky spot because the second to last thing, the last thing that they want is for the same thing to happen that happened with Kevin Durant, where they think that Westbrook's going to stay, and then he doesn't next offseason. The difference, of course, between this and Kevin Durant is that the Thunder were not able to offer Kevin Durant an extension, which would have been financially beneficial to him. And because of the new collective bargaining agreement, which kicks in on July 1st, and new extension rules, they're able to offer Russell Westbrook an extension, which would be financially beneficial to him. So if he turns down a financially beneficial extension, then you kind of have an idea, okay, well, he's been here for 9 years, and he's already not willing to lock into a contract which would be significantly bigger than what he could get from another team next summer.
Let me expand it just a second on that. It is the most favorable possible contract. There is he by agreeing to that extension, he is taking zero risk because it would be the maximum that is available at that time, whether the cap goes up or the cap goes down or anything like that, and he gets it a year in advance. So basically, it's kind of like, if you were given a blank check to work at a company and you said no, well, then they think that you don't want to work there anymore. You know, that's just the way it is. And obviously none of us are lucky enough to get blank checks at our jobs, but you would know something if that happened.
Right. And the last thing the Thunder want, like I said, is to have another Kevin Durant decision. But more realistically, and I don't think they necessarily will because of the way that the extensions are now, I think the second to last thing they want is a Paul George decision. They don't want that Paul George situation where Westbrook turns down that extension, and whether he turns it down because he says, hey, I'm 70% coming back. I just want to be able to see what else is out there, or I want to see how this season goes, or if we win 50 games, then I'll do it, or whatever it is. I don't think they want that, but they don't want that situation where Westbrook, they offer him the extension, Westbrook says no, and now all of a sudden they're hoping they can get something 50% on the dollar for him just so they can, you know, not lose him for absolutely nothing.
If it happens, and I think many of us hope that it does not, you're choosing between bad options. That's just the way it works. And I mean, I mentioned this before with the plans, but this is where a general manager makes their money. I mean, you have to figure that out. If I know that certain people would find this strategy risky, but I would pretty much tell Westbrook flat out right now, if you tell us no, we're trading you. And because they can't afford that risk. You know, if they go through this season taking their best player, because remember, Oklahoma City has spent money on Steven Adams, on Victor Oladipo. Presumably, if they bring him back next year, they're going to Jeremy Grant, Andre Robertson this offseason. It's not like they can rebuild on the fly. They can't wipe this all down and kind of go at it fresh. That's not the way this works. So they need that piece to figure all this out. And I think he owes it to them to do that. And he doesn't owe it to them out of some sort of loyalty or anything. He just owes it to them out of professional courtesy. And so I would tell him straight out, you know, if you say no, we're going to trade you. And that's fine. If you want to stay, we'd love to have you. If you don't want to stay, then thank you from the bottom of our hearts for everything you've done. But we have to do what's best for us.
Here's another trivia question for you. You know, the last time a reigning MVP was traded, not including sign-in trades, the last time a reigning MVP was traded?
My first thought was Moses Malone, but I might be wrong.
Well, Moses Malone was traded, but even though the rules were weird and different back then, I'm counting that as a sign-in trade.
Okay.
He signed because Moses Malone, I forget the exact details, but Moses Malone signed, this is summer of 82. Moses Malone was on Houston or Philadelphia? He was on Houston.
He was on Houston and was traded to Philadelphia.
He signed an offer sheet with Philadelphia. Houston matched the offer sheet, but then that same day, Houston traded him to Philadelphia.
Yeah, so which is a rule that they have since changed.
Yes, but that is principally like in the concept is the same thing. So I'm not quite counting the Moses Malone one.
So then is Kareem?
He was not a reigning MVP.
Oh, that's right. So you're gonna have to tell me then.
It was, I think the year Kareem was traded, it was Bob McAdoo was the reigning MVP. But
That could be. I have trouble with MVPs in those years.
It was Wilt Chamberlain in 1968.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. That's how long ago it was. So it could be the first time that a reigning MVP is traded in nearly 40 years. I don't know if it ever happened before then. I didn't bother going back farther than 1968. I went back 40 years, and I was like, okay, that's enough clicking on Basketball Reference. I don't need to find out more than this.
Yeah, and what's crazy about that is, like, that was Wilt, and that was the second time he was traded, because the first time he was traded was years before with the Warriors, and then he went to the Sixers and won the NBA title against them in the finals the next year.
Yeah, and then he went to the Lakers. 68 was when he went to the Lakers.
Correct.
All right, I think we covered just about everything. Is there anything else? How much money do you think Deion Waiters is going to get?
I think he's going to get more than 10 a year, but less than 15. But I think the question for him is going to be years. I think he gets 3 and he's going to want 4.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. At least he's going to get
so
paid.
I'll give your listeners one thing. I've talked about this on a few different things, but it's an important concept, which is see who moves early, who puts pen to paper early, and who does not. Because my instinct is that other than high-end guys, obviously, the players who sign on July 1st are going to get the best deals for them than the guys who wait. And so the example, this was true last year too with Timofey Mozgov and Noah and all that, because just money dried up a little bit. This year, the money's going to be gone fast. So the players who try to get too cute with this, and this is another way where agents make their money, who you choose to have your first meeting with is and how you square all that up is going to be exceedingly important this year.
And Danny, I want you to tell people, okay, this is my favorite. I told you, this is genuinely my favorite podcast. It is better than my podcast. And I can tell people to listen to this now because we're so far back in the episode. You've already listened to this podcast. So you're not going to listen to yours instead of mine now. So I've tricked you into listening to the worst podcast if you're listening to this and you only have an hour to listen to a podcast. You should listen to Dunked On Mock Off Season, that series. Do you want to tell people about that? Because it is so good. It's so fun. It's extremely informative. It's just a fantastic idea that you guys do annually for a podcast, and it's great. It's really good.
It's an incredibly fun undertaking. So the premise is Nate Duncan and I do the Dunked On Basketball podcast, but the mock off season is a larger group, and so it's Nate is the player agent for all players, and then Kevin Pelton of ESPN Insider, Dan Feldman of NBC, and myself each get 10 teams, and we negotiate in full faith as those 10 teams. And so we develop a work like an order of free agents. And this year we had to deal with Paul George. We wanted to do a Paul George trade. We tried to do a Melo buyout, all that kind of stuff. And so we go through, we don't go through everybody. And the thing that we do limit are trades just because those get more complicated. So we go through not only all the high end free agents, but most of the other guys. Dion Waiters is in it, guys below Dion Waiters. He's like middle of the second episode. And so I don't know what the final product turns out. I think it's about like 4 hours of material. You can go as far as you find it interesting, but it is also a great, like, as an experience, you also get this sense of, as a listener or as us doing it, of how the market is going to shape out. When does the money dry up? Who does the money dry up on? And then what do you learn from that? What does that mean moving forward? And we've found, while we're not exactly necessarily accurate in terms of what everybody gets, that the general contours are usually pretty good.
It's great. It's really, it's like a fantastic listen. What, my favorite podcast of the year, Danny. I really do mean that. It's like really my favorite podcast of the year. And where can, I'm sure people will want to read your stuff throughout free agency and beyond. So where can people find your work?
I don't know exactly where each specific piece will be. That's why a great thing to do is follow me on Twitter, Danny LaRoux, DannyLeroux. But I write for the Sporting News, Sports Illustrated, maybe Real GM, and I'll presumably be doing work for The Athletic as well. And yeah, I mean, my stuff goes all over, and then podcasting, Dunked On Basketball Podcast, Nate Duncan and I, and then Real Jam Radio is my solo weekly podcast, which you've been gracious enough to be on at least once, I believe.
Have I been on that? I think I have.
Yeah.
I think I have been. I know I've podcasted with you, but you do so many podcasts that I don't quite
that
remember
is true.
Which ones I go on. Yeah. You can remember I'm on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. If something major happens with the Thunder, I'm going to be in Orlando and Vegas Summer League. So I leave for Orlando on Friday. Then I leave for Vegas the following week. If something major happens over the weekend, like on July 1st, Russell Westbrook signs an extension at midnight on July 1st or anything like that, I'll do an emergency episode. Some big Thunder news, I will do an emergency episode if something happens in free agency. If not, then I'll be back Monday again. I'll do Monday, Wednesday, Friday next week, no matter what. But again, like I said, if something big happens, I'll do an emergency episode on that day. You know, whether Westbrook extension is probably the biggest thing that can happen. If they decide not to guarantee Samaje Christen's contract, then I will just wait until Monday. You can head on to iTunes, though. Subscribe to Locked On Thunder there. Questions, comments. Email lockedonthunder@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter at Fred Katz, FREDKATZ. And log on to normantranscript.com for all your Thunder needs. Check out Thunder Road to follow team coverage and what's next for the Thunder there. That will do it for today. I'll be back Monday, maybe sooner. Danny, thanks for coming on, man.
Anytime. Appreciate you having me.
And so I'll be back on Monday, maybe earlier. But until whenever it is, Locked On Thunder is locking up.